Want to build an eight-figure e-commerce empire? Find out on today's special episode with our guest, Ronnie Teja.
Today's episode is brought to you by Descript. Every book, podcast, and YouTube video that I publish is transcribed by Descript. I've used all of the competitors, and nobody comes close to their quality. And the price is the lowest in the business as well. If you want to speed up production and grow your online business, go to servemaster.com/descript right now.
Are you tired of dealing with your boss? Do you feel underpaid and underappreciated? If you want to make it online, fire your boss, and start living your retirement dreams now, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to Serve No Master Podcast, where you'll learn how to open new revenue streams and make money while you sleep. Presented live from a tropical island in the South Pacific by best-selling author Jonathan Green. Now, here's your host.
Now, I'm very interested in what you do because so many people, the first thing they say when we talk about watches are like, I don't wear a watch anymore. My phone tells me what time it is. And the other people are people whose watches are hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it's like, really, to me, it's so risky to have something so expensive on your wrist. And that's why people lose their watches all the time, right? It like would make me so nervous to have a $50,000 or $100,000 watch. So I'm very interested because your watches aren't crazy expensive, but they look nice and you have a lot of interesting things going on. So I'd love to know maybe how you first decided that watches were going to be the business you go into. Where did your passion for watches come into and how did you decide to go the e-commerce angle?
Sure. So thanks for having me, Jonathan. There's an interesting story behind how I started my watch company. And the story is this. I read somewhere that the margins on quartz watches are about 75%. And I said, wow, how am I not making money off of this? So essentially what I did was I found out where the one center, epicenter where quartz watches were made. And that epicenter is Shenzhen, China, right? And the world's largest watchmaking fair that happens in the world is in Hong Kong. So I'm from Vancouver and then basically took a one-way flight. There was no coming back from there and took a one-way flight to go from Vancouver to Shenzhen. And I said, look, there's an opportunity here to manufacture quartz watches at like 75% margin. So personally speaking, when I started, I wasn't much of a watch fanatic. I got into watches because I saw others like Movement and DW and all these guys, the OGs of micro brands, actually excelling at it. And I said, I can do what they can do, but I can do, you know, a little better than them.
I think that's something very interesting because a lot of people think, oh, I have to be passionate about whatever I do. When it's 99% of people hate their jobs, right? They just do it Monday to Friday to get the paycheck. But they think, oh, if I start my own side business, I have to love every part of it. And it's that old saying, if you love your job, you never work a day in your life. I hate that saying because it's not true. There's no job where you love every aspect of it. There's nobody who like loves doing the accounting as well as running their business, right? Only accountants love accounting, but it's still part of it, right? There's always something that's the job part. So it's really interesting to hear from someone who's, no, this, I just saw an opportunity as opposed to I was a watch person originally. Because I think a lot of times when people approach from a passion, this is why there are so many golf inventions. People like golf keep making golf inventions. And how many inventions from 10 years ago around? Probably none of them, right? But they get too passion driven. They're trying to find that balance. So that's very interesting to me. So when you went to this fair and you're in China and you're looking for this angle, are you looking for someone who's going to make watches based on your designs or as designs that you can just put your brand on? Like what's the approach you take when you're looking at entering this market?
Yeah, sure. So the interesting part that ended up was, so I called a buddy from university back then. I only had $3,000 or $4,000 in my bank account. So of course the money was working against me. And it's an interesting situation. So I called a buddy from university. I said, look, I'm coming to Hong Kong. Hong Kong is a really expensive place. It's like New York in terms of its living expenses and everything else. So I said, I'm not booking a hotel. I'm coming to stay with you. So stayed at his house, lived and boarded for free and ate all his food. And every day I would go to this watch and clock fair. And the watch and clock fair basically happens for about 2 weeks. And every morning I'd start from one floor. And it's about three floors. And every morning I would go from one floor and cover all three floors. And I'd basically take my designs, show it to the guys and be like, hey, this is what I want to do, but this is my idea. And I think I did that for a week. And one of the days, this old gentleman, he looked at me and he said, look, I see you coming in here every day. I see you pitching your ideas. I see you doing all these things. But do you know how quartz watches are made or how clocks are made? I'm like, dude, I have no idea what I'm getting into. But all I do know is there is an opportunity here that I want to pursue. So lo and behold, from the generosity of this guy who owned a watch factory, he says, come to Shenzhen, stay with me, right? And he basically said, come see how watches are made. So that's essentially how I found out how quartz watches were made to start off with.
And how do you decide how many designs to have, because some watch brands have hundreds and hundreds of designs. It's like when you say, oh, I have a Rolex, that doesn't mean anything because there's such a wide range of designs, from things that are $100,000 to things that are a couple hundred dollars now, right? And even if you say, oh, I have a Submariner, it doesn't mean anything. Well, what year, what color? There's seven features to figure out what it is on the range. So how did you find where you're going to fit as far as pricing and as far as how many different designs you have? Because some people, they go really far down that path of, I'm going to have a million designs. And they said, it's especially bad for clothing because you have to have every size. I'm going to have extra small all the way to 3X, all junior with massive amounts of stock. And you have to guess not only the design, but the sizes. So there's a lot of complexity. So with watches, how do you decide how many different designs you're going to start out with when you're launching your brand?
Yeah. So the interesting part about this whole situation is threefold. So always test out before you launch, right? The name Brandio came through a Google survey, because I'd read somewhere again that if you name your watch an Italian sounding name, people are probably going to like it. So I put out like at least four or five different names, domains that I wanted to buy, did a Google survey for a week, and Brandio was the top winner. I said, okay, this is the brand we're going with. Bought the domain for $10, and that was it. In terms of designs, a similar strategy was applied, which is basically later on it's evolved, but when I started, it was basically I had about six different models, tested it out on Google, and there were two clear winners, right? By a fairly large margin. And we said, okay, these are the two ones that we're going to go with, and then we're just going to evolve it from there, right? Today, we test out in a different way, i.e. we basically disperse our new designs to our email list and ask them to pick the winners, be like, hey, you get to be a part of this, and you get to pick the next best watch if you want at the end of the day, and we'll give them a free watch, right? We'll give them a free watch in case their design wins, or et cetera. I mean, the cost to company on that is next to nothing. However, your customers feel appreciated that they get to be a part of the decision-making process, which is the next level. So you feel engaged in that it's your decision that actually matters at the end of the day.
There are a lot of people that try to enter these markets and it doesn't work. I know some people, they go, oh, I'm going to go straight into drop shipping. So they're going to order watches one by one, ship them from China directly to the consumer, and kind of they have that really long delivery cycle, which crushed a lot of people over the last year when supply chains slowed down and shipping got so slow that now it's like, oh, your watch will be there in 6 weeks. Now, when I grew up and you ordered something online or from a magazine, they were like, it'll be there in 6 to 8 weeks. And you just accepted that. But these days, no one would ever wait 6 to 8 weeks for anything to be delivered. So what are some of the other people who are trying to do similar things with e-commerce brands or with micro brands or bringing products from China to America? What are they really doing wrong? What are some of the biggest mistakes you see, and how can people avoid those really common mistakes?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I went through the same situation as well initially, which was Amazon had just launched, I think. Amazon delivery back then in 2013 was a 5-day delivery process, if I'm not mistaken, right? They came up with a 2-day delivery or the same day delivery in your city in 2017, if not around 2016, 2017. The thing was, I was pretty upfront with my customers when they ordered. I said, it would take you a week to receive your product, right? We were using the cheapest means we could. We were bootstrapped. We were trying to shave costs where we could. And we said, it's going to take you 7 days to receive your product. Now, fast forward it to today, right? You give people the option. The option is you can either get free, you can pay for delivery within 2 days, right? Which is going to cost you $9.95 or $19.95 or $14.99, depending on your region or where you want delivery. Or if you wait a week or a week and a half, you'll get it straight to your doorstep for free. Most people choose the free option, but it's not the paradox of choice. You give them the choice. Choice matters in terms of the customer and how fast they want the delivery, how slow they want delivery. So at least 30% of our stock is US-based. There's still about 50 to 60% of our stock that is similarly dropshipped from China directly from the warehouses, from Hong Kong, essentially. And that takes about a week and a half. But if people do order and if they want their delivery within 2 days, we do deliver to them within 2 days.
How much of the margin goes into the shipping cost that you're eating when you give them the free shipping?
That's an interesting one. Margins, unfortunately. So are we talking about COVID margins or are we talking about post-COVID margins? Because shipping's come down, right? What you have to also account for is like shipping a container that used to cost us $3,000 pre-COVID, and now it's leveling off to the same sort of prices. During COVID, jumped from $3,000 to about $21,000 a container. So it's a 7x cost. So in some cases, during COVID, we did have, like, there were some cases where we would break even, right? I mean, usually we would consider a 10 to 12% of the total gross margin to go into shipping, right? Today, it's 10%. During COVID, that figure was about 22% per watch, which is, you basically double your shipping cost, which is crazy, right?
And as you're seeing other people who, like you said, when you first saw it, you saw other people that were trying to do watches and there were things going right and things going wrong. What have you noticed when you saw the opportunity? What did you see that you could do better? What are the big mistakes other people are making or the opportunity in the market?
Oh, yeah. So that's an interesting time. 2013 is also the nascent years of Facebook ads, right? I mean, you could, there were cheap CPMs. Influencers were coming in extremely cheap. You know, it's, you could basically do a live Instagram live or something with Kim Kardashian for 100K. With this, so there was an opportunity for us to start taking these chances. So usually the way we would position our budget is 80% of it goes to tried and tested methods. So Facebook ads, Instagram ads, Google shopping ads, all that stuff. So that actually does still is 80% of our total media spend budget. 20% of it we'll test out. So when TikTok came out, we started advertising on TikTok. We got influencers on TikTok. That helped us scale a lot. And then, of course, today, in that 80% mix, we also have TikTok. And then we'll still pursue 20% for using get emails or retention.com or something else. Try and always be testing with 20% of your budget to see where the new opportunities are. So when I started, a lot of people were doing Google, but not a lot of people were doing Facebook and Instagram. And, you know, Instagram influencers were taking off back then. That money from Instagram influencers has now switched to YouTube influencers, which is a completely different ballgame as well. And I find YouTube to be a lot more direct and a lot more conversational with the customers. Podcasts is another one, right? We would sponsor podcasts where it was extremely conversational, where people are talking about certain pieces and people consume the media in different forms. I mean, the main crux of the conversation is the moat that we intend to build is around the media that we have. And ideally, we would prefer to own the media.
And so there is this constant flux between advertisers and media, and you can see a lot, like there's a lot of trends lately with a lot of Facebook, a lot of YouTube advertisers turning out to be not what they were offering, right? There's been a bunch of YouTube advertisers that have suddenly had to disappear because no one will work with them anymore because of all these things going on with how they treat their influencers or how they kind of, it always catches up to them if they have a short-term win. So when you're trying to create, there's always that risk, right? Of a backlash, right? If you underpay your influencer, it saves you money in the short term, but in the long term, they start to hate you, right? They'll let it out on other streams. I've seen that happen a few times to some big brands. How do you establish a relationship and figure out what's the right amount to pay someone? Like, how do you go through that process without, you don't have to go into specific numbers, but more about the, what are you assessing? What are you looking at? What are the risks and rewards with this type of marketing? Because a lot of people really don't understand influencer marketing, because I've seen people with massive same size followings. One person's getting $400 a video, the other person's getting 10,000, and they don't know the difference.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, actually. So I can take it through how I would assess it personally. When I'm assessing an influencer, what we would do is we would work back from the cost per thousand. What is the cost per thousand of impressions, right? So if I were to say drop a YouTube video today and advertise for it and say the cost is, let's say $20 to $25, that's Canadian, right? That's where my usual CPM would fall. And if I'm to get a YouTube influencer, say within the $15 to $20 range, it's a no-brainer for me. I would sign them up immediately and I would say, okay, this is coming in a little below what I would pay for my YouTube ads. And this is actually a much better medium because I have a very captive audience, right? There's of course, a mix of micro, nano, and large-scale YouTubers. The larger the audience, of course, there's a premium associated with it, which we are willing to pay. If you're a nano or a micro-influencer, of course, we'll give you what market rate is. And that market rate is determined by what your cost per thousand is compared to what YouTube is. The interesting part that comes down to it is we usually work with only YouTubers who are there for the long term. I mean, it's coming, like, of course, there's the influencer side. There's also the advertiser side. The advertiser side is we pay all our influencers up front, right? And in some cases, they've disappeared in the short run, which happens, right? And that's the cost of doing business. In some cases, it happens. And you have to be able to write it off. I mean, I think I've lost 20, 30 grand doing that kind of stuff, but it's okay. Like we are in the business for the long term. We are in the business for the next 10, 20 years, and we are there to nurture relationships. I think as a person, I personally appreciate relationships that I've built over the years, one-on-one with influencers or with the reps at ad agencies or reps at Facebook, at Google. It's the same sort of, I guess, mindset I would apply in this case.
Different social media platforms have different longevity. Like today, I was watching a video from 3 years ago that had that inbuilt ad that they recorded for some brand. And I'm sure they got paid a long time ago, right? And there's a really long tail to it. That's like the beauty of YouTube, right? People watch videos a lot longer, whereas it's very rare for someone to watch a TikTok that's more than a week old. But one of the interesting things about TikTok is that some small person can have a video blow up. So there's more opportunities, right? So is it when you're developing your strategy with these other platforms, with Instagram or TikTok, is it better to get like 10 influencers that each have 10,000 followers or one influencer that has 100,000 if it costs the same? Because my feeling's always been like on TikTok, well, I got 10 shots of it going viral, right? It's it increase the odds of going viral for the same price, or is it better to go for the larger influencer?
So you brought up a couple of really good points. So number one is the longevity of YouTube, right? So when you talk about like pay once and just leave it there forever, with YouTube influencers, we usually end up paying an affiliate commission after. So we'll say, okay, look, these three to four months is what I paid you for. But in the future, if there is an opportunity to sort of work with you, we will continue paying you affiliate commission on each sale that you drive. So that way, when we talk about not taking advantage of your influencers, this is something we put in place, just to come back to the conversation. Number two, when you're talking about TikTok, Instagram versus YouTube, I almost prefer YouTube because YouTubers, from my experience, you always think about the audiences first, right? Instagram, I consider to be very self-driven, I guess, because you know it's a sale coming on Instagram, right? TikTok is an interesting beast. TikTok is, I definitely would agree with your assessment of, you know, saying, look, if you were to put the same amount between Instagram and TikTok, I myself would choose TikTok before Instagram, because there's 10 different shots of you, of your content going viral. So for me, that sort of equation would always be YouTube number one, TikTok would definitely be number two, just because of the audiences and the virality of the content.
How much integration do you look for between the channel, like the type of content they're making, and your branding? Because I see a lot of YouTube ads. Like everyone on YouTube always seems to be running the same ads, right? They're all doing, everyone seems to have no matter what they're talking about, they do a VPN ad, or they do an ad for this wallet that everyone, that no one has, Ridge. But everyone advertises. Like,
that's Ridge, man. That's my buddy Sean. Sean Frank, he's a legend.
They're like, how do you choose? Do you care that much about the integration? Do you only want to be on watch channels, or you just look for channels where your demographic watches the content?
We are looking for specificity, I would say, right? Ideally, specificity is something that would help. A watch is very interesting, right? People who like watches will only watch channels. It's a disease. Like, I don't know. It's people who smoke cigars will only watch cigar channels. It's not a very broad. It's not as saying, hey, look, it's not like a mass market thing like an iPhone, right? Watches are extremely specific, and people who like watches like watching extremely specific content that's towards it. I don't know, what's a passion of you? I'll give you an example. Like, what is it that you love? I see you have really good podcasting mic, and your setup and your studio is amazing, right? So maybe you've gone down the hole of how to have a setup for your home studio, and maybe you're a photographer. And I also see a great gaming chair in the back. So chances are, I would say you do have consume content from a gaming channel. So it's sort of that niche, right? It's like the content that you would consume is very specific to your own needs, versus a Teddy Belzer who makes really good content related to watches, versus, I don't know, Mr. You Know, who might be a different category altogether.
And because sometimes, like, I look at like parallel things, like when I've worked with other men's brands on projects, we're like, oh, what are things that guys watch? Like, every guy I know watches lockpicking videos, right? We all have that part. You know what I mean? That's like, oh yeah, I could do that. Like, I could be a spy if I need to.
100%.
Or we watch like a woodworking one. Like, yeah, if I needed to, I could build that. Like, there's a part of us, like, obviously it takes years to develop these skills, but we watch those. Or the guy, like, I know a lot of people that watch those, they build a house in the woods, that thing. Like, there's some of those that like seem to be like every guy watches those, right? And so they're not directly watches, but they're parallel. So when you're looking, because there's only so many watch channels, right? So then you're looking for the next thing around it, which is...
People who like watches, like cigars, like whiskeys. So yeah, so you bang on the money on that sense. It's not just one. There's usually something, there's some commonalities. Wine, fine dining, whiskeys, watches, there's a few. There's about, the next level goes about only about 6 to 8.
That's very interesting. So my next question is, how many watches does like a person buy, like, in their lifetime with you? Is it they buy one watch and then they're gone, or are they buying a new watch every 6 months or every year? Because again, my dad was a watch guy. He was one of those guys that had like 20 watches, and they were, big time. And he had the spinning watches. He had 50 pairs of shoes, 50 jackets. He was one of those guys that was really into fashion. I'm at the other end of the spectrum. Maybe it's a rebellion thing, like, or maybe just my phase, but you know, you have the watch that keeps spinning because the watches are like, I wore a really good watch for a long time and no one ever noticed. When I finally could afford a Rolex, I wore it for a year. Nobody noticed. I go, well, what's the point? So for me, it's the external validation. Like, I don't wear it for how it makes me feel. It doesn't make me feel anything. So that's just me. But I do know that people who get into it, a lot of people have collections, which seems to be like, is that kind of your demographic, or the person who goes, oh, I just need one watch, and then they come back in 5 or 10 years?
Say, that's a really good question, actually. So quartz watches, so... And I'm at the lowest end of the spectrum, right? I'm not your dad's level, and I'm definitely not your level. So our brand basically is a very mass market produced watch. It costs you $100, $150. It's like, looks nice. I like the color. I like the dial. I'll buy it, right? versus something that your dad and yourself wear, which is what I call a Rolex is a masstige brand, right? A Rolex is a masstige brand because whenever you think about the, and please, this is just my explanation of it. I might be wrong on this, right? Which is when you think like you made your first, you hit five figures for the first time in your life and you get that $100,000 a year paycheck. I don't know if that's a thing now. I think I'm sure the needle's moved on that to 150, 200K. People usually think about buying a Mercedes Benz, right? It's like, wow, I've got a Benz or I've got this amazing car. So a Rolex is similar to a Mercedes Benz. It shows prestige, right? But on a very mass level. So hence the term masstige. Your father, for example, probably is a couple of levels above it too, because if he's in the watch hold, he probably owns a Lange & Söhne, right? He probably had Rolexes, but he had brands which were perhaps even more niche than Rolexes, which was, you know, could be a GP, Girard Peugeot, could be like an MB&F, could be like, so a watch lover after a certain point of time goes down a hole which is more mechanical. So they're in love with the mechanics of the watch. They're in love with just looking at, you know, when they wind the watches and just hearing the tick, 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 tick that goes on. So for example, I own vintage watches from the 30s and 40s, which I prefer to be a lot more appealing to me versus watches that came in 2010, 20 later on, which is like the Rolex Sub or something. So a watch is very personal and it's make it your own with the story that's behind the watch for you. So every time I've had an exit because I own a portfolio, every time we sold a business, I'll buy a watch to remind me. Would I wear a watch in public? To be honest, Jonathan, I'm a little scared myself to wear a watch in public, given that if you travel to certain cities, right? If, for example, in London, people are even getting, they get held up for wearing like a Moon's watch, which is a $200 watch. Anything on your wrist is basically gold, so they'll take it. So when I'm out in public, I'll probably wear my own watch or I'll wear like a Moon's watch. But for certain events, you have to bring out the nice one. Sorry, I went off track on that.
No, that's great because that's exactly what I went through. It's like you go through the phase where you start making good money and you buy a bunch of expensive stuff for a while. And then I don't use an expensive phone anymore for the exact same reason. Like I don't want to lose a $2,000 phone. Like it would be so annoying to me. I use a $200 phone and I have, every time I look at upgrading, I just can't see a reason to. I use my phone so rarely. It's not a primary part of my business. I used to be a phone business. Now I'm much more running from the computer. And it's just like, again, you don't want something. I live in a third world country. I live in Southeast Asia and you have to be a lot smarter. A lot of people here, you don't want to, you know, show off and create attention to yourself like some dummies do. And it's like, those are things exactly that you think about. It's like, well, I don't want to everyone to go, that's the richest guy in the island. Like, that's the last thing I want people thinking. And so sometimes, and also I have four kids. I'm always like, well, I can buy them something really cool instead of buying myself something, right? I'm in that phase of dadhood. But it is very interesting to me because I think a lot of people thought watches were going to disappear once they added like a clock to a phone. Same thing, like everyone's like, there'll never be a flashlight again because now cell phones have flashlights, even though the flashlight on a cell phone is not that good.
Yeah, exactly.
Do people buy like several different color watches to go with their different outfits? Like this is one I'm wearing a blue suit, this gray suit.
Oh man, you're touching it. You're touching it right now. Yes, people match their watches. I have a friend, I think he's probably got 300 or 400 watches and he'll wear each and every one of them. Some people buy 50, 60, 70 watches and they probably never wear them. Some people have 400 watches and they know how to pair it and they pair it with the outfits, right? It's like the analogy would be like women in handbags or women in shoes or, you know, so it's kind of like on the male spectrum, it's kind of similar, right? It's how you dress in that dressy outfit and how you get along with it.
Yeah. My wife and I went on a trip last month for a whole month. We were away and the first day I was like, maybe I should start dressing up again. We live somewhere very tropical. It's so hot. All of my good clothes melted. Like they just melted into a cube in the attic. All my leather jackets, all my tuxedo jackets. It just, that's how hot. And I said, maybe I should start wearing nice stuff again. And so I bought some slacks and shirts. I know what I like, right? We're going around, we go to the big store and I'm like, let's go get some ties. And I only wear skinny ties. I have this whole thing, but she's like,
yeah,
how do you need
them?
Like,
guys, man.
I'm like, I need at least 30. So I, whatever mood I'm in, she's like, those are both pink. I'm like, they're not the same pink. This one is shine. Like, I'm that way about skinny ties for sure.
Yeah.
It was like, and I've only worn three of them in the last month. I'm like, yeah, but when there's an emergency, like it's a whole thing for you. So I get very much about that. And so I do understand the pairing thing. I think that's very interesting because a lot of people, when they think about entering a market, they don't look at, there's kind of different people. There's the people that are like, hey, I just want a watch that works. I'm never going to think about it. When it dies, I'll buy the next one. Then there's the people that want, like you talked about, that like really care about the mechanics. They know how different Rolexes function. Like they know, oh, a fake Rolex ticks, but a real Rolex spins, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
or maybe have a back investment. Like those are things they know. And I have a friend who's really into high-end watches and he knows this type of gem actually, as the watch ages, it gets more accurate. Like he really cares about accuracy to the second on his watch. And it's so important to him. And I get that's fine. And then there's the people that like, no, it's part of my accessories. Like when I was single, yeah, I had 50 different wrist cuffs, 50 different belts, and it was like a whole process to get dressed. 6 pairs of shoes, not like 100 like my dad, but it's like I have to put together an outfit to be the cutest I can possibly be. I don't have a lot to work with, so I got to really maximize myself using fashion. And it's like the people that are pocket square people, there's no pocket square guy that only has one. Yeah. You either have none or you have a 500. There's no middle, right? And there's a whole thing to it. So you either are into it or not. And I think that's what's really interesting is that for every hobby, or for every accessory, there are people that obsess about it. Like there's people with 500 belt buckles, right? And it's like, oh, I have to wear the right belt buckle for the right thing. So I think that's really where the interesting part happens. So when you think about the future of e-commerce and where things are going in the future, what are the things that kind of have you excited about the future? And what are the things you think are going to start to fade away? Because I've seen for a while, everyone thought it was going to be NFTs. Like I care what a picture of me is wearing, or everyone thought it's going to be virtual reality. I don't know anyone. And no, actually, it's true. I've met one person who owns a virtual reality helmet. I don't know if he ever uses it, but I've met one person ever who has one, right? And sometimes we double down and we believe in technologies. Like they've been trying to do virtual reality since I was 15 and they had it at the mall and it was terrible then. And I still don't want to try it. But they're like, oh, you can accessorize your character in a game. I'm like, yeah, that's not real to me, right? Like I want something I can hold. So I get the thing about a watch. It's a physical thing. There's a lot of mechanics to it. It's interesting to see how it works. All of that stuff is very interesting.
If I may interrupt you, the reason, I know I'm in the watch business, so I'm a bit biased, but I'm going to say something which people might have thought about or may not have thought about. The one true piece of jewelry that a man gets to wear is a watch. So
yeah, it's like you can, if you're famous, and I always wonder about this, like these, when do you start to wear all the accessories, right? When do you start wearing 15 bracelets? After your first movie, right? Or when you decide you're going to be an actor, right? Or when do you start having 7 necklaces? You know what I mean? It's like there's a big gap between how normal people dress. I don't wear exactly that. I don't wear any jewelry, only if I'm going out. I don't even wear my wedding ring. It's so hot here, right? It was my wife talked about it. I was like, I don't leave the house. I haven't left the house without my wife or one of my kids in like 8 years. So it's not like I need to wear it to prove it to anyone. But I was like, this is just so uncomfortable. My finger's always itchy. And I just used to wear rings, right? When I want to look cool and all that stuff. But you're exactly right, is that most accessories, especially once we get married, right? Like we really transition. Men go through the different phase. Like, well, I don't have to try as hard anymore now, do I, right? Like once with the boss. You know what I mean? Like, let's be honest.
Hopefully we're being honest. Why hearing that in the next room, man?
Don't worry. She's got a really good life. Like she has an awesome life. She's like, I'm like, do you want me to buy another watch for me or something for you? She always chooses her. So we have that system. But you know what I mean? It's like you don't wear 6 bracelets. I don't wear a wrist cuff on every wrist. I don't wear like 2 necklaces and all these things. But it was a phase. I did it a lot in my 20s and early 30s, but now I've just moved to the next phase where I'm just about comfort, right? You go through those different phases where you care about flash, then you care about comfort. Like it's why you see when people get rich at different ages, the way they spend their money is different. Like it seems like everyone is rich in their 70s. Unless you want a spaceship. Like there's the generation, like, what do you want to spend your money? I just want to go to space for 4 minutes. And that's not my age. That's older than me and younger than me. They want a car where the doors go up. Like I don't even own a car. I walk everywhere.
Yeah.
Live great. On a small island.
Love it.
So it's very interesting. So let's talk about the last thing I want to talk about. This is very interesting. Is the future of e-commerce. Where do you think things are going? Because there's been kind of consolidation and fragmentation, right? It's like everything's Amazon. No, you can have your own small business. It's those two schools of thoughts. Where do you see the future going? Like, is Amazon going to just keep eating up every other business, or is there room for individual sites, for individual brands to keep growing?
Look, it's pretty interesting from that perspective, right? It goes back to what I had said earlier, which is you want to give the customers the choice to find you. So we are not on Amazon just because Amazon has a really weird policy on jewelry and watches, which is i.e. that in a period of 2 years, they can basically return your product and then it's your issue. And people on Amazon, of course, people like my mom, they'll just order stuff off Amazon, try it on and say, whoops, I don't like it. And then just send it back in a couple of weeks. So, you know, and once your return rates get high, Amazon just basically bans you. And I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. Second thing for me personally is Amazon was a race to the bottom. So we have the same suppliers as some sellers from China, and then basically they'll sell the same product for $50. And I'm not going to dilute the brand. However, having said that, if you have a strong brand, I think it matters for you to be in retail, matters for you to be on marketplaces, it matters for you to be as a D2C. On the D2C site, you should be able to control your brand at the end of the day. So I think giving customers the choice to find you in different places is extremely important. However, it has to make fiscal sense what the customers are doing at the end of the day.
So do you think that kind of the market is flooded? Because I directly agree with you on race to the bottom. When my wife and I were running a hotel, when we first opened up, there were 5 competitors. This is a few years ago. Within 2 years, there were over 500, and they were all dropping the price to where like they're losing money every night. Like the competition went crazy. So I was like, let's get out of this business. Let's have another baby. I talked to my kids. I'm like, hey, what if we turn the guest rooms into a massive playground? They voted yes. We had another kid. I was like, 4 kids. We don't need to run a business out of the house. We ran it for 2 years. We just sold off everything a month before they kicked off the lockdowns. Like we got, and all those businesses went out of business. But it is something where people have this idea about that price is the most important aspect. And it's something very important that I want to talk about. A lot of people make that mistake. They go, oh, price is the most important thing. But there's also a price when you go too low, people get suspicious. Yep. Like I was like, hey, I got a Ferrari. It's $14. You're not going to believe me, right? Like you just go, there's no way. It's a trick of some kind. You don't know. You might not know what it is. Maybe the car is stolen. Maybe it's going to be a micro machine. Maybe it's going to explode. But you know it's a trick. And so sometimes people, and this is very interesting. One of my friends one time who's in real estate goes, I would never even look at a real estate course that costs less than $5,000.
Yeah.
And that was very interesting because most people are like, $5,000 for a training course, that's so expensive. But at each tier, people are like, well, I wouldn't do something that goes below X, right? I wouldn't buy a t-shirt that costs low than whatever their number is. Everyone's a different number, right? And so even if a watch is beautiful, if it's $4,
yeah,
you're not going to wear it because you're still in your head going, it's a $4 watch. People are going to see it, right? Oh, it's a, like, I have one, like, we all have a friend who wears fake Rolexes. I have a friend who bought like 30 of them because he kept losing them when he'd go out drinking. He had a real one at first, lost it one night drinking. He goes, well, I'm not doing that again. If I'm going to keep losing them, he bought a 30 pack, which I thought was hilarious, the fake ones, and he just kept losing. But we all have that different thing of where you're thinking about the value on a risk. So yeah, when you push down, you start to get the, like you talked about, the high people that pay less refund more, complain more. I always found that when we tried to lower our price, we had just worse customers, people who would bring their own food from home, wouldn't rent any surfboards, wouldn't do any activities. And so we lost the secondary revenue. And it's, you don't want to go too low because you get the customer who, well, they can't afford anything and they're just going for the cheapest, as opposed to people that are in the middle. They're doing a little bit of, well, I want something that I like. And if it's too low, I don't trust it. And that's the one of the dangers of race to the bottom. Also, you can never win. You can never go low enough to, because there's always someone who can go lower. And then nobody's making any money. So I think it's a really important lesson for people to realize that price is not the barrier very often.
Yeah, price is not the end of it. Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've done price testing of at different levels, and I can share some experiences on it. We try to be a $70 watch brand. We try to be a $100 watch brand. We try to be a $150 watch brand. The sweet spot is $125 to $150. At the $70 watch brand, like you were saying, you get a certain kind of customer. They love the returns. They love to take you for a ride. I mean, there was a time that in India, we had expanded to India, and basically we were selling watches there. And the amount of returns we used to get, man, it was always people demanding more service. I don't know why at the lower price point, at the lower threshold of the market, people tend to be more demanding for a lot less price. So, and I said, this is not our headache. Just let this customer base be somebody else's headache. We'll move up the value chain.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you're very strategic about choosing your price band of the market, because a lot of people, they want to be a luxury band, even though I think all luxury brands are owned by one company, it seems like, right? They own everyone, all of
There's
that stuff.
There's about three or four of them, Richemont, Rolexes, and LVMH. These three ideally own most of them.
Yeah, I think LVMH owns like everyone else, right? And it's like, you think that, oh, I want to be luxury, but the problem with luxury is that people don't buy luxury items that often. Like how many people buy more than one car a year, right? Very few. Whereas, and that, not that many people, whereas if, or most people in their lifetime, I think buy two houses, right? They buy a house and then later buy another house. That's it. Whereas watch at the high end, such a small number of people that are buying that, right? There's very few people buying watches over 25 grand. And there's tons of people buying watches at $10, but finding your right bandwidth and going, this is where I'm going to be because this is where we have maximum profitability and can minimize customer support, which is such a big part of a business, especially a business with physical products. Returns can kill a business. I've seen that happen.
100% it does, man.
Just make the wrong return policy or you have a misspelling on your privacy policy page. Boy, is that a nightmare. So this is all really good stuff. I think people are going to be very interested. And again, your watch brand is called Branzio, B-R-A-N-Z-I-O, for people that want to check it out. They're nice watches, very interesting brand. I think it's been really great. Where can people see more of what you do? You want them to just go to their website, or where else do you want people to visit you, see what you're doing, and see how this brand is growing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you can follow me on LinkedIn, Ronnie Theja, just look for that, or on Twitter, same thing.
Perfect. And we're going to put that in the show notes. We'll put them below the video on YouTube. I think people are going to love this. It's really interesting to see. There's a lot of different ways to build a business online. And I love having people that are doing different things. Thank you so much for being here. This has been a really cool episode. And I know that people are going to absolutely love it.
Thanks, Jonathan. I appreciate you, bud.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. I love podcasting, and it's never too late to start your amazing podcast. Get started with my free guide at surfmaster.com/checklist.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Serve No Master podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you never miss another episode. We'll be back next week with more tips and tactics on how to escape the rat race. Please take a moment to leave a review at servenomaster.com/iTunes. It helps the show grow, and more listeners means more content for you. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.